Okay, welcome back for episode 98 of Powers and Principalities. Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thanks. So, tonight we agreed to talk about the United States Constitution, the supreme law of the land, as they say. Well, the U.S. Constitution, the Constitution of the United States of America, is the supreme law of the United States, empowered with sovereign authority of the people by the framers and the consent of the legislatures of the states. It is the source of all government powers and also provides important limitations on the government that protect the fundamental rights of the United States. So says the White House. Of course, I pulled that from the White House website. The famous quote, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity, to ordain and establish the Constitution for the United States of America." This is according to the fine folks at Encyclopedia Britannica, of all places. The Constitution. Why Constitution? The need for the Constitution grew out of the problems with the Articles of Confederation, which established a firm league of friendship between the states and vested most power in a Congress of the Confederation. This power was, however, extremely limited. The central government conducted diplomacy and made war, set weights and measures, and was the final arbiter of disputes between the states. Crucially, it could not raise funds itself and was entirely dependent on the states themselves for the money necessary to operate. Each state sent a delegation of between 2 and 7 members to the Congress, and they voted as a block, with each state getting 1 vote. But any decision of consequence required a unanimous vote, which led to a government that was paralyzed and ineffectual. Sounds like heaven. A movement to reform the Articles began, and the invitations to attend a convention in Philadelphia to discuss the changes to the Articles were sent to the state legislatures in 1787. In May of that year, delegates from 12 of the 13 states, Rhode Island sent no representative, convened in Philadelphia to begin the work of redesigning the government. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention quickly began on drafting a new Constitution for the United States. The Constitution was written during the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by 55 delegates to a Constitutional Convention that was called ostensibly to amend the Articles of Confederation, the country's first written constitution. The Constitution was the product of a political compromise after long and often rancorous debates over issues such as states' rights, representation, and slavery. Delegates from small and large states disagreed over whether the number of representatives in the new federal legislature should be the same for each state, as was the case under the Articles of Confederation, or different depending on the state's population. Eventually, the framers resolved their disputes by adopting a proposal put forward by the Connecticut delegation. The Great Compromise, as it came to be known, created a bicameral legislature with a Senate in which all states would be equally represented, and a House of Representatives in which representation would be apportioned on the basis of the state's free population plus 3/5 of its slave population. The inclusion of slave population was known separately as the 3/5 Compromise. A further compromise in slavery prohibited Congress from banning the importation of slaves until 1808, Article 1, Section 9. After all the disagreements were bridged, the new Constitution was submitted for ratification to the 13 states on September 28, 1787. In 1787 and 88, an effort to persuade New York to ratify the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison published a series of essays on the Constitution and Republican government in the New York newspapers. Their work, written under the pseudonym Publius and collected and published in the book form as The Federalist, became a classic exposition in defense of the Constitution. In June 1788, After the Constitution had been ratified by 9 states, as required by Article 7, Congress set March 4, 1789 as a date for the new government to commence proceedings. The first elections under the Constitution were held in late 1788. Because ratification in many states was contingent on the promised addition of a Bill of Rights, Congress proposed 12 amendments in September 1789. 10 were ratified by the states, and their adoption was certified on December 15, 1791. Of course, the Bill of Rights were all, you know, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment about guns, First Amendment about freedom of speech and freedom of exercise religion. The Fourth Amendment protects citizens from unreasonable search and seizures, requires government to obtain a warrant, a search warrant with probable cause under authority of a judge. There's, of course, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, which should be important, but for some reason the government has ignored those. The federal government has pretty much declared them a nullity. Of course, in the Constitution, the founders took great pains to establish a relationship between the states. States are required to give full faith and credit to the laws, records, contracts, and judicial proceedings of other states, although Congress may regulate the manner in which states share records and define the scope of this clause. States are barred from discriminating against citizens of other states in any way, and cannot enact tariffs against one another. States must also extradite those accused of crimes to other states for trial. The founders also specified a process by which the Constitution may be amended, and since its ratification, the Constitution has been amended 27 times. In order to prevent arbitrary changes, the process for making amendments is quite onerous. An amendment may be proposed by 2/3 vote of both houses of Congress, or if 2/3 of states request one, by a convention called for that purpose. The amendment must then be ratified by 3/4 of the state legislatures or 3/4 of the conventions called in each state for ratification. In modern times, amendments have traditionally specified a time frame in which this must be accomplished, usually for a period of 7 years, of several years rather, I'm sorry. So that's kind of a rundown on the Constitution itself. Of course, that's sort of a very, I guess, basic history and explanation of it. There's a lot more there, I think. A lot more controversy. The Constitution also supposedly, you know, created a federal government of specific enumerated powers. But within the Constitution, there's such wording as necessary and proper clause, general welfare, and these things. And this is this vague language has been exploited by the federal government to pretty much mean it can do anything it wants. Now, to the point now where the government pretty much says just invokes general welfare, necessary, proper, or actually, yeah, another one is also the Commerce Clause, meaning they can regulate anything if they just describe it as commerce, commercial activity. And of course, every, you know, I guess any activity has some impact on commerce. So that's what the court has decided. And this, of course, this arduous amendment process has pretty much been bypassed by things like the creation of administrative states, bureaucracies, and this, of course, is done particularly through the New Deal and also the various wars, but also judicial activism. The federal courts have, the Marshall Court, Justice Marshall, who in Marbury versus Madison, more or less seized the power of judicial review, sole judicial review, although it's nowhere in the Constitution, and that gave the courts a role of interpreting the constitutionality of laws. And since then, the courts have been very active in interpreting the law, misinterpreting the law, engaging in all types of legal sophistry to expand the federal government. Very rarely do they use that sophistry to limit the powers of the federal government. But there's a lot more to hear. So, Joe, that's kind of my take on the Constitution. What do you have to say?
Well, I mean, I would first like to change the first line of the Constitution. That would be the first thing I would like to do. Where it starts out, we the people, before that, I would like to have the phrase, none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free. That's a quote from the Freemason Johann von Goethe. But I think that would be the right, you know, sentence to begin the Constitution with, because it's, basically, if you, what the Constitution is, it's a camouflage for slavery. And it does this by creating the facade of democracy, but a particular kind of democracy that can be easily controlled by the groups who are creating the government. And so, you know, if you want to like kind of understand how the Constitution works, you have to go back and look at how it was actually created. And so the first thing you would need to do is to simply look at the Benjamin Franklin's first constitution, because this wasn't the first constitution that Franklin worked on. He actually edited and then reprinted Anderson's Constitution of the Freemason, because this, in fact, is the founding of the United States. It's the 1734 document. Now, that document then was, I'll get into a second, but was obviously used, and it's agreed upon. I mean, no one, I think, really seriously looked at this would contest it, that the Albany Plan, which was the precursor to the Articles of Confederation and the Continental Congress, the Albany Plan was 100% just basically they just scratched out Freemasonry and put in, you know, U.S. government, because it's the same thing. So the first thing is you have to look at the Masonic Constitution, and what it does is it says that the Grand Lodge is supreme, right? It's, in other words, the federal government. You have voting to select officers. The governance is limited by a constitution, and then there'll be a kind of sovereignty in the lodges underneath it, like the states, right? So here's where you have states' rights and a federal government. But the key trick is that they say that there is a kind of judicial review whenever there's a, you know, a dispute, that's going to be carried out by the Grand Lodge. So this would be the Supreme Court, basically. So now the words, you know, can be reviewed by people who are appointed. And so basically what is going on in between like 1730 and 1790, you know, when the Constitution pops out, is a process is going on whereby the Masons were able to gain control over basically the government by this concept of the federalism, right? That the federal, that powers that, you know, and it's very incremental. I mean, it starts out with states having a lot of power, but the direction is always, you know, well established, right? They're going to be moving to power being centralized, because this is what they can control. Remember, this is a tiny minority. You're talking about, you know, I don't know how many, you know, can't be tens of thousands. It's certainly maybe 1,000 people are actually in the Masonic power structure. They want a dictatorship, and they know that they have to get people to think that this thing is not happening. So they start out with the Albany Plan, and the Albany Plan was it was, you know, Franklin created it. Ben Franklin created it, and it is well known that it was basically the seeds that would eventually define the American federal system, the division of powers. It was all laid out in this Albany Plan, but with the very important distinction that they did not try with the Albany Plan to make the federal government more powerful than the states. Remember, this is incrementalism. It's the only way that they can do it. And so in the Albany Plan, they have this idea that the states would maintain as much power as the federal government. So the next step would be the Continental Congress. Now here, you have to remember how wired and fixed this deal is, because the Congress is being run by Peyton Randolph, he is the Grandmaster of Freemasons in Virginia, and he is working primarily with Franklin, who is the Grand Master of the state of Pennsylvania, right? So basically, these two guys are the administrative heads of Freemasonry in the United States, and they are creating a document which is a mirror of the Freemason system of control. And remember, you know, Freemasonry is a system of slavery, basically, because of the oath-taking. You know, of course, at the top, it works. You know, there is freedom there if you're inside that group, but below it, they have these system of oaths. So they're trying to replicate it politically without the population knowing what they're getting into. And you have Peyton Randolph, who is incidentally the first president of the United States, He is too old and sick, and he appoints Washington, who was his lodge brother. And of course, again, it's you can see how the wiring of Freemasonry through this whole thing. Now, in order to get the population to basically make the transition from state rights, where these are local areas of power, to accepting even the first version of federalism, because remember, federalism, as you said, expands over time. But even to accept that, you have to have the so-called Revolutionary War. And again, it's just a completely wired Masonic situation where you have, you know, the Boston Tea Party with the lodge members from the Green Dragon going out and complaining about taxes, which could have easily been resolved. But the Mason King George is being stubborn. So the Masons, you know, Paul Revere and Hancock and Washington, all these guys are saying, oh, we got to have a war. Now, in the war, right, you have heroes, patriotism, you know, and of course, nationhood, right, that seems to be important, even though people don't really understand why it's being, you know, what's in back of it all. But then this leads to basically to the Constitution, where you have, where you have federalism is established. And of course, if you look at, you mentioned the Federalist Papers, I mean, that's like as Masonic as the Boston Tea Party, right? So they're definitely moving toward a situation where the people will be thinking that they were, that there is some kind of freedom. It's because they're able to vote. But it's sort of like Trump or Hillary, as long as they're controlling at the top. And remember, they are controlling the media at this time. I mean, think about the pamphleteering to create, you know, the Boston Tea Party. So they have the printing press, you've got Franklin, you've got Revere, these guys are creating a lot of literature. Now, I just wanted to, you know, to say is like with Franklin, one thing that really kind of is eerie is that remember when they dug up the guy's house a few years ago, they found 11 bodies in the basement.
Yes.
You know, and they were going, gee, why is this? You know, well, just remember how murderous these people are. Just how murderous they are. I mean, look at like Garibaldi in Italy, you know, and blood-soaked Helen Blavatsky. I mean, these people are just murderous. So now...
The Hellfire Club, right?
The Hellfire, yeah, there it is. So anyway, so now you've got... So now they start, you know, with this Constitution thing. And of course, you know, if you look at the people who are creating it, they go, well, you know, 13 of the 39 signers were Freemasons. But then maybe another 10 joined after the fact. I mean, this is stupid. They're all Freemasons. It's just some of them we you know, don't have the lodge identification. But it's just a, you know, a Masonic project to create a structure where the people think that, you know, they have some kind of power. But actually, you know, they have like the Grand Masters, Peyton and Franklin, are already basically in political power. They bring in Washington, who is, you know, a complete 100% puppet. And now you've got, you know, you have then the sequence of presidents. And they'll say, well, John Adams wasn't a Freemason. This is just preposterous. I mean, of course he's a Mason. He appoints Marshall, who's the other Grand Marshal, I mean, Grand Master, to be the head of the Supreme Court. And you see, think about how few people they have to actually control. All they really need is the president and majority of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and he, I think the dispute that culminated in Marbury versus Madison, I think was a result of Adams packing the court at the last minute.
Yeah,
and Jefferson not giving them their commissions.
Well, you know, and they talk. There's all these like problems. They go, well, Jefferson was, you know, this or that. Look. Look at Jefferson's gravestone, right? Mm-hmm. It's one of these Masonic obelisks. He designed it himself. You have the drawings of the thing. It's a secret society, Tim. They don't give up the identifications of everybody who's in it. And so it's all, I think that this is 100% wired, that the concept of federalism is just the same concept that Wolfgang von Goethe is laughing at us, right? He is one of the big German Freemasons. None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free. Well, that's us, right? They give us the Constitution, and then you know that. So you know, what brings about the transition to federalism would be like, you know, they say they need money for weapons, basically. They had the Shays Rebellion, you know, where, yeah. You know, they had, and they go, gee, how are we going to put down, you know, like rebellions? Well, I mean, Shays didn't, he wanted to be free. He thought he was fighting in the Revolutionary War, not to have like some guy who could say he could tax him.
But yeah, same with the Whiskey Rebellion too, yeah.
It's same for the Whiskey Rebellion, exactly. And so the thing is, these are the real voices of freedom.
And that was a great example of how, you know, sort of how the game is rigged from the start. Was the cause of the Whiskey Rebellion was a result of the excise tax that Hamilton had gotten passed under, I guess it was under George Washington, to pay for the assumption of the estate of the state debt by the federal government. And the trick was that there were a lot of the average guys, soldiers, farmers, who had loaned the money, were now holding bonds that were now worthless, or only worth pennies on the dollar, so to speak. And what happened was Alexander Hamilton was an agent of Governor Morris, an early, you know, American oligarch, who financed the revolution, also financed the Constitutional Convention, who's sort of the power behind the Washington, you know, presidency. And they knew in advance that the assumption bill was going to become law, and that debt would be made good, paid with gold. So Governor Morris and Hamilton sent out their agents, went out and bought that debt, you know, from the thousands of debt bondholders who thought it was worthless. So they were happy to get, you know, a few pennies for it. And then you turn around and the law is passed, and all of a sudden that debt is now made good with gold payments, and they're going to be taxed to pay for it. And a lot of the tax was on whiskey, and whiskey, for these people's currency, it was, you know, for these people, so it was a particularly onerous tax. And it was also the outrage, because now they had sold the debt under, you know, not understanding there was an inside deal going on. So it was a bond swindle, and the United States government, fittingly, the United States got to start as a result of a bond swindle. So.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I mean, and it's still being kept afloat by a bond swindle, mm-hmm. basically. Which is called the U.S. dollar, you know, and our treasury knows. Yeah, you know, so
public debt's a blessing, as Hamilton said, right?
Yeah, that's right. It is, because it creates more federalism.
Yeah,
you know, read the Federalist Papers. I mean, talk about sophistry. It's just insane. You know, they're saying, yeah, we need more centralized, you know, focus, right? But you know, so anyway, so basically, the Masons had the problem of how do you get the population to think that they aren't enslaved. That's the basic deal. Mm-hmm. And so the Constitution. It's kind of complicated, you know, you've got the three parts to it, but there's a lot of voting, and then you can, you know, you can get angry at your congressperson or your senator or whatever, and then, you know, little by little, we get to the place we are now, where it literally is slavery, because now the president doesn't even go through the, you know, the pro forma of, like, getting the Masons in Congress to vote for a war. He doesn't need to waste his time. He just starts blowing things up.
Yeah, we're given the trappings of Republican government representation, even controversy and disputes, a lot of sturm and drang out there. But at the end of the day, the regime gets its way, despite what the Constitution, what the letter of the Constitution may read, what the original intent was, or what the public wants, the public be damned. The fix is in, and we see that all the time in various judicial rulings, you know, that don't seem to make any legal sense if you're really, you know, doing a good faith reading of the Constitution, but it's someone interested in what's being advanced, whether it's Obamacare and the insurance industry, and that's, of course, so imposing sort of this long way to imposing a scientific dictatorship, or, you know, various rulings throughout the years, you know, when Woodrow Wilson wanted to draft people to fight in a conscript people to fight a war in Europe, there really wasn't much power there for the federal government to conscript to draft people for such a thing, and people sued. You know, say, wait a second, there's no, you passed an amendment. You know, remember the 13th Amendment about about slavery. You know, and they said, well, no, it's not slavery, it's service, and other countries do it, so it's all constitutional.
Yeah. My favorite is the decision to permit pornography on the internet under the First Amendment.
Yeah, the Freeman rulings,
freedom of speech. Yeah, like this, what exactly is being spoken? You know, so it's preposterous,
and really, even if you have a government, which, you know, you have this governance painstakingly created with division of powers, the Bill of Rights, and these things. The problem is so much of what occurs now is outside strictly is not strictly speaking within government. A good example, it's occurring now with free speech, where now private corporations now are effectively suppressing free speech. And then, of course, what they're saying is, well, it's not us, it's the government. And all of a sudden, these liberals are advocates of, you know, of non-interventionism. You know, it's like, yeah. Oh, that's private. We don't regulate private. You don't regulate private companies, really?
Yeah, and that's why, you know, really the Constitution, I mean, honestly, it just needs to start out with that expression so that people have a chance to defend themselves, you know, mentally, because once they get into the hocus pocus of this, you know, tripartite government stuff, they're just lost. They can never find their way out. It's created as a slave state, and this is just the puppet show. The Constitution is like the longest running puppet show in history. And there is, it was created by Masons for the so that the public would not rebel against Masonic control. That's the sole reason for it. So all of the song and dance about, you know, the appointing the Supreme Court justice. I mean, and that's why, you know, the history is very useful, because you can actually trace, want to do it. You can trace the Freemason Constitution, which was 1734, mm-hmm. which was edited by Franklin. So there's no question, to the Albany Plan, which he actually created. And so you can just, it's transparent. You can see the relationship between the structure of the lodge and the judicial, the tripartite slave system that the Masons could, you know, create. You can see it right there in the Albany Plan. And then the articles are a little vaguer, but, you know, because they're still trying to appease the concept of the people in the different states would have a state government, right, that would be on an equal footing with the federal government. But then when you get to the Constitution, now this is collapsing and the states' rights are, you know, really, they're delineated. You know, there are only certain things, and it's that if it isn't like inside the Constitution, then the states have the power. But there's, since there is Masonic control over the Supreme Court, what does the expression really mean? Interpret the Constitution as broadly or as narrowly as they wish, and then they get their way.
Yeah, they get these rulings. In the 30s, you had a series of rulings, you had the presumption of constitutionality, this doctrine. I think it was U.S. versus Coraline Products, I think is the name of the decision. But basically it said that all federal laws are presumed to be constitutional unless there's an explicit violation, which is sort of turning the Ninth and Tenth Amendment on its head. That's a presumption of constitutionality in these things. And you had some give back, like you had the Four Horsemen on the court who held back some of the New Deal legislation, but then FDR signaled that he'd pack the court and they backed down, and there was switch in time that saved nine, as they said. That was, and the court just said, okay, we'll just say yes to everything. And really, between 1937 and 1995, not one federal law was found to be unconstitutional. This was, of course, an era of rapid federal expansion, and really a huge amount of legislation was being produced. Much of it was constitutionally dubious, but they didn't find anything unconstitutional. And it shows you just, you know, sort of the bias. And what's interesting is that, you know, you have the Articles of Confederation, you have the U.S. Constitution, this gradual consolidation of power, but it's not so much what's written, it's written on parchment that determines these things. After all, the Soviet Constitution granted all sorts of rights, but it didn't change reality on the ground. And you can make the same argument about the U.S. Constitution, how pretty much the regime ignores parts that it finds inconvenient. I mentioned, you know, the fact that, you know, the 13th Amendment banned involuntary servitude. They don't want to construe that to keep them from conscripting people to fight in their, you know, the bankers' wars overseas. So they just say, well, no, it is constitutional because other governments do it. That's pretty much what the court says, you know.
Sure.
You know, or when some of the New Deal legislation, particularly regarding agriculture, I think it was trying to put price controls on agricultural goods. And it was Wicker versus Filburn, which said that even a farmer couldn't even grow his own wheat because that activity had a potential effect on commerce. You know, so now the Commerce Clause enables government to come in and tell people what they can and cannot grow on their own farm. You know, and of course, we didn't shoot ahead in the future where Obamacare, the federal government can mandate you to buy health insurance from a few select companies. And not only that, it can tell you what you have to buy. it can tell you what type of healthcare, how much you have to pay for it, and these things. All this, and of course, that was done, found under the taxing authority, another violation of the Constitution, because I think the Affordable Care Act was actually originated in the Senate, and the Supreme Court ruled, this is just how, they don't follow their own rules. They contradict themselves. This is how, you know, how mendacious the whole thing is. Well, if that is indeed, if that was a tax, and therefore constitutional, it would have to originate in the House, not the Senate. But then again, why bother with such details? But my point is that what happens is we have the Constitution, all these guarantees, Bill of Rights, they look great on paper, right? We have three, tripartite government, separate branches, all jealous of their own territory, so they check each other, so allegedly. And you have the states and their governments and these things. But when the reality is when the state consolidates, when you have things like railroads, increased military power and communication, this is getting into sort of cybernetics, the means of control are established. The letter of the law, the Constitution just becomes a scrap of paper, because now those in control, the government, the oligarchs who control the government, now have physical means to control, and to the law, to hell with the law. And that's what you get. So you have this, people, historians recite sort of this gradual approach to history where just a culmination of events, a sort of centralization, this is just natural course of things. And so inevitably that's going to affect how the law is interpreted and what kind of laws are passed and how we live and these things. But this, as the highways are built, the railways are constructed, communications are established, the means of monitoring and surveilling, the Constitution gets warped along with those. So basically the Constitution serves the machinery of the regime of the state. It doesn't limit it at all. And so it's just meaningless. It's just absolutely meaningless. The moment they can, they're opportunistic. When they have the technology and the means to control and ignore the Constitution, they don't give a damn about the Constitution. It doesn't hold them back at all. And they have judges that are trained to provide the legal sophistry to justify it all. Or the issue, because we get, now you might want to address this, the whole function of secret societies, black ops, what we have now, the cryptocracy, secret government, the intelligence agencies, and just the function of think tanks or even the foundations that constitute a secret government. They're completely outside the realm, of the Constitution of the governmental structure. Yet, impose huge influence or enact huge influence on those institutions and what we think and how we, advertising and psychological warfare, what we expect, what we think is going on, and what we think, what informs our political views is controlled by the secret society through their foundations and bureaucracies and NGOs and think tanks.
Right. Well, my favorite constitutionality is 8-5, where Congress has the right to coin money and regulate the value thereof.
Yeah. I
mean, this just makes me laugh every time I read it. I mean, how does letting a private bank owned by a few banking families have unlimited power of credit creation and establishing interest rates?
Yeah, the Coinage Act.
How's that regulating the value? Because,
yeah. I mean. And they didn't amend the Constitution for that.
Yeah, this was exactly what the clause is supposed to prevent, and they just laugh at it.
There's a non-delegation clause.
Yeah. So this is the thing. It's like you said, they knew they could control the top of it. They had the people in place already, basically, to do it. I mean, obviously, look at the Grand Masters running the thing, right? And when the Continental Congress, right? I mean, it's absolutely transparent. The Grand Master of Freemasons are running the thing. There is no structure of power. These guys are in charge. They're creating the language. And so there it's transparent, but they knew that they would be able to control the federal tip. This is the whole trick, is they knew they had enough control over the media. Think about like the Boston Tea Party and the pamphleteering and Franklin's printing press. So they had enough control over the circulation of ideas. And they had the people in place, right, to take the reins of power. They're all murderous. They're going to, absolutely, they have to, like, look at Franklin's basement, for God's sakes. Those are probably the people that opposed the federalism, He killed every one of them, And so So this is what happened. They basically barged in. They created this fake, legal process that had federalism at the tip. They could control it really with only five people. I mean, all they needed was a president and five people on the court, or six people. So they needed six human beings. That's all they needed, and then they would have complete control. And as long as the population thought that this was not only, democracy, but that there was patriotism, right? Because remember, the war, which is, this Masonic project to create the crisis that will then create this government, the war also created propaganda. I mean, look at it today, where in the NFL games, where they bring out all of the, families of the victims and things. I mean, this is how mind control operates, but it was operating back then, where they would have patriotic parades, and the idea is that you associate the war with your own interests, and you therefore, because it was Uncle Remus that got killed, and you're honoring him by honoring the war. It's just a very simple kind of mind control trick, and that stops people from being able to say, no, he died because he was fooled. He died because he died for someone else's creating a slave camp that our family has been put into. And so the Constitution and federalism, the best approach is to just try to get people to see it as, part of the technique of the Masonic control of the country to keep them from seeing themselves as enslaved. That's my take on it. Just you got to get people to come to that level of understanding of the thing. And it's, you won't get there if you just follow like the current, dialectic moment, where it's Roe v. Wade or something. You got to go back and see that, look, these are all the Grand Master Masons, and they were definitely aiming for those that know what happened. Can't just, be, caught up in the emotion of the moment. We have to try to look backward and see the process, what was guiding this all the way through. I mean, to me, just if you just look at the Mason control, right, over like the Albany Plan or the Articles of Confederation or the Constitution, it just begs the question. You have to wonder, wait a second, this is a tiny little group. They're completely controlling everything, right? This isn't democracy. What kind of democracy is this? It's and what is ending up that if in the big picture is states' rights are being destroyed, right? So you have Masonic desire to create federalism and states' rights being destroyed. Those are the big strokes that you have to be aware of when you look at the Constitution.
Yeah, because those would present obstacles to the Masonic project of centralization. So they can pay lip service to it, and they can be confident in due time they'll be able to coalesce the resources and manipulate the agenda to the point where they can impose their will, which they did do eventually. But so they can pass the Ninth and Tenth Amendments to the Bill of Rights, and be confident that these things will, in due course, just be declared a nullity or a truism, as the Supreme Court has said, where the whole idea that the Congress can pass a whole bunch of regulatory laws, and then under the Necessary and Proper Clause, the Supreme Court can rule that, well, Congress has the power to enact these agents, empower these agencies to enforce the law. And most of what we are confronted with the federal code and regulations have nothing to do with legislation. It's bureaucratic fiat or enforcement, and you have no say. The same with judges who are appointed for life and then engage in judicial activism. And now we're supposed to bow at their rulings when they're obviously absurd, like Obamacare or Roe v. Wade or the Obergefell decision, gay marriage, where it's obvious, to invoke the 14th Amendment for that as equal protection. Do you think the people who passed the 14th Amendment, as problematic as that was in 1866 or 68 when they passed it, intended that to mean that people could invoke the two people of the same sex could invoke the right to marry? That's ridiculous. And to the point that, to the extent that these issues were put up for the people for a vote, they usually were turned down. It took the court or bureaucracy to impose these things on the people. And then after, you know, a certain amount of time, we're told that, you know, just this was popular will. It's ridiculous.
Of course it is. And, you know, the thing is like the idea of domestic tranquility, general welfare.
Yeah.
I mean, that these are, what happened to like freedom of association?
Well, yeah, that's another thing with the
like with domestic tranquility. I mean, isn't that really what people were fighting for to a large extent? You know, a lot of the people would, and so, you know, it's.
Well, I mean, take your example, the 14th Amendment, right? The 14th Amendment, which I guess granted the privileges, immunities, and rights to the freed slaves, you know, after the so-called American Civil War. Well, the Reconstruction Amendments were passed under the threat of the bayonet, you know, because for the purposes of passing, the federal government said these states are no longer states. They left the Union, but wait, I thought they couldn't leave the Union. So they did leave the Union. Now to be brought back in the Union, they have to pass these amendments or else face military occupation, you know, for eternity, I guess. So even under its own rules, these amendments weren't passed. You know, and then when it didn't pass, they actually expelled a senator from, I think it was New Jersey, who was Stanton, I think was his name, who didn't like it. But they had to, because the regime wanted it. But now, shoot, in the future, what's the 14th Amendment being used for? I mean, the best argument against the 14th Amendment to how it's been since interpreted, you know, it's, you know, whether it's busing, forced integration, and these things, you know, all these abuses, all this coercion, and where's the right to voluntary association, freedom to associate? You don't have that right anymore, if it conflicts with the social engineers. But again, it's one of these things where we think, you know, the government is supposed to follow these rules, but then they change the rules of the game when it suits them, you know.
Yeah, and that's why the Constitution is such a, you know, well-crafted document.
It's a living and breathing Constitution.
Yeah, it's breathing, all right. Yeah, it is.
It's undulating.
It's just like the corpses in Franklin's basement, you know. I mean, this thing is as dead as a dorm. It was always intended and has always been the case that just a tiny minority can basically use this document to manipulate their will, and then when they want, you know, basically arrest and destroy people who stand up against them. I mean, this is really what we have, you know. It's that's the truth, you know.
A good example is, like, the Constitution also says for public accounting that all government budgetary items should be released to the public. I mean, I think in 1974 there was a lawsuit to try to find out what the CIA's budget was, and it was found out that the person had no standing because I guess they weren't. That's another thing the trick does when you sue about these things. They say you don't have any standing because you can't prove you're being harmed by it. It says, well, how do I know that unless I find out what they're spending money on? The same thing they pulled a few years ago with the wiretapping. The Supreme Court ruled that those who were suing couldn't prove standing because the wiretapping is covert.
Oh God!
Wait a second.
The people put up with it, you know. So that's the thing, is that, you know, you need six people, or now I guess, you know, there's more, but in the Supreme Court, but, you know, 11 people, and you got, and particularly if you also control the Federal Reserve, and it's just a very, very few people can.
Well, that was, I mean, you've had these various coups, right? And one with the coup of 1913, when you had the creation of the Federal Reserve in violation of the Constitution. Because it granted a private bank the right to control the money supply, but you also had the direct election of senators, which changed a lot, and you also had, of course, the passing of the federal income tax. But you had, you know, the New Deal revolution. They see the expansion of the managerial state, growing out of, I mean, obviously it was underrated by the First World War and the bureaucracy that was needed to wage the war. And a lot of these New Deal agencies kind of grew out of that. But you have these various coups. So we say it's the Constitution, but it's not the same Constitution because it's just been legal sophistry, and it's completely distorted and misinterpreted, whatever meaning it ever had. So it's not the same Constitution. It's not the same government. It's a different, completely different form of government than when it started out. But again, your point is well taken. That was the plan from the get-go because you had all the vague language was there. And anyone knows anything, if you allow lawyers vague language, what are you going to do with it? You know?
Yeah, well, that's right. You know, and it's funny because I actually looked through, the constitutional decisions. You know, you can use Google these days for such things, you know, and I was looking and I was trying to find one I was going to bring as an example of where the Constitution had worked out for the little guy, you know, missing one. It's sort of like that quote you gave a couple of shows ago that I just was so charmed by. I just keep repeating. I know I'm boring people, but it's like, you know, when the guy told McCarthy, he says, McCarthy, look, if it wasn't a conspiracy, every once in a while we'd win one, you know?
Yeah.
And you look at the decisions of the Supreme Court, particularly relative to states' rights or little guys' protection versus federalism. We never get a break.
No, it's,
never.
Yeah, it's interpreted most broadly if the court is deciding on the level of government power, but if it's individual rights, it's always the most narrow interpretation.
Well, it's also the most culturally debasing.
Yeah,
and you can be sure that pornography is going to be permitted as under Article One.
Really? Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Pornography in the internet is legal because of Article One. Why is this free speech?
Yeah.
You know, what is the actual expression? You know, isn't this just a product that's being sold, basically? I mean, how can we possibly transmogrify the words in the first article to be able to fit this thing into it? But they just do because this is the project, you know. Then, and I think it's like with abortion. I mean, they can't give enough abortion away, right? It's just an easy way to get the population reduced.
Yeah, and whenever a state, I think recently Ohio passed a law that was called the heartbeat law, restricting it to, you know, nothing past 6 weeks when you can detect a heartbeat. I'm sure some federal judge is going to smack that down.
Of course.
And that's their job. It's not there to read the Constitution and say, wait a second, you got it wrong in every way. This is sophistry. This is nonsense. Penumbras and emanations. I don't see any penumbras and emanations. No, they're to strike it down because stare decisis. You got to honor the ruling.
Well, Tim, he's there to protect the constitutional right of women. Because, I mean, this article question mark, they have to be able to have abortion, you know. And so it's just the whole thing is just kind of preposterous.
Well, the funny thing is like the 14th Amendment, you know, how it's used to justify birthright citizenship.
Yeah.
And how I think there was a ruling in the late 19th century regarding Chinese workers who were legal immigrants. They were legal immigrants and there were children born here and it applied to them because they were legal. Of course, at the time, there were no restrictions on immigration legally. But now it's been interpreted that any person gets here, even if they get here illegally, they can have a baby and that baby is a citizen. And now, I mean, that's I don't know. Obviously, if you want to interpret the law that way, you just want to promote, you know, the mass immigration, people to come here.
Well, I mean, and of course, get past the terms because it isn't so much the mass immigration, it's the mass debasement of the core population.
Yeah.
When you have a high fraction of first and second generation people, particularly ones that aren't coming even from European culture. Well, how in the world are they going to participate in a way to like stand up to the oligarchs
who come here illegally from the get-go?
Of course.
How is that supporting domestic tranquility when you create a situation like that?
Yeah. So anyway, to look at the legal system is simply to look at the Masonic system of genocide and of dictatorship. That's all it is. And you know, it was kind of like when we talked about discussing the Constitution. I actually was, I was thinking, well, you know, I want to go positive because I get some comments, people saying that I'm usually like criticizing things, you know, and I go, well, you know, there's got to be a lot of good things about the Constitution. So I was looking for, you know, like times when it's used to help little people think. Nah. There's just nothing good about it. It's completely ridiculous. It's just because there isn't any way for the basic problem, Tim, is that it sets up a system whereby the powerful maintain power. That's what it does.
Yes, it's the oligarchs. It's the creditors versus the debtors, the oligarchs versus the little people.
Yeah. So the problem is at the beginning of the nation, it was an oligarchy. People didn't understand it, but it was a Masonic oligarchy. It was a secret society. look at all of the Grand Masters creating the damn document, right? So
and again, that Bond Swindle that I mentioned is a good example. Look at the type of games they play, how they get rich.
Yeah.
And then they buy up the media, you know, the newspapers or.
Yeah, and then and any kind of free speech gets bought up, you know, because they can make fake money. So
and we see it today with the control of the, you know, the tech giants and Google and Facebook, all paid for with deep state money, black budget, how they use that to consolidate control, you know, the transmission of ideas and speech, you know.
Sure, and that's why, you know, when you, again, you know, just to reiterate a point we've made many times, is that when you look at Amazon, a company that never made any money and has $1 trillion capitalization and is taking over all, you know, basically all systems of commerce and food and everything else, well, you know, maybe we should think about, gee, is this the same thing that kind of produced the Constitution? You see, it's never changed. It's never changed.
Yeah.
World War II, World War I, the Civil War. These are all just genocidal projects, reduce population, ratchet up the slavery step by step. And at the same time, they're developing technology, which they're going to use, I guarantee you, as already are, to ossify the slave state. So
you can't have a meaningful constitution, a meaningful electoral process, a Republican form of government, when you have institutions like the Federal Reserve printing funny money to buy up everything, because they can just grow. I mean, they can control. They can manage perceptions, control, engage in mass mind control or psychological warfare to manipulate everybody and buy up everybody, buy up meaningful opinion. You know, well, they can pay for the Walter Cronkites of the world and all that.
They can create wars to get rid of the Irish population that's coming in during the Civil War period to make sure they don't vote them out. They can create poverty, you know, what that can do. And then if all else fails, they'll just do mass immigration because these populations will be trivial to control. So, you know, basically the cookbook of the oligarchs is pretty big. You know what I mean? They've got a lot of different recipes they can use. And the cure, if there is one, it lies in the information revolution. The people have to, when you get something like, you know, Roe v. Wade or, you know, the first, the creation of the protection of pornography on the internet, The struggle on like the spiritual or moral level is just cannot be won. That's the area of their sophistry. You've got to expose the weaponization of it. This is how the information revolution can be won, is that every time they do crap like this, we don't buy in. It's like trying to argue with the Dr. Hofitz about, you know, vaccinations. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't. What you do is you point out that it's been weaponized and that this guy is genociding us. You don't go into, you know, you try to stay away from, you know, the like his BS, like that, you know, vaccine or autism, a genetic disorder. Don't get caught up in that. Try to always bring up the most central point of reality. And that is that these are oligarchs that are genociding us. This is what these legal decisions, these medical decisions, that's what's in back of them. And if the public doesn't get that information, right, then you won't be able to make a clear-minded decision about how to deal with it, how to get, you know, some relief, you know, in terms of like a democracy that makes a little bit of defense for us. And that's why, you know, I'm not kidding. I would love to see the Constitution printed with that phrase from Wolfgang von Goethe, because it is really the best first step to reading that document. Man, if you are hopelessly enslaved when you falsely believe you are free.
Mm-hmm. I still like pulling out parts of the Constitution and trying to embarrass them with it. Or
oh, sure. I mean, I'm not saying that. That's a great process because it wakes people up.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the because, and a lot of people they're used to being, it's hard to get to get them to the point where they want to, like, you know, proceed on Goethe's insight. That's a long journey. How do you get them there? Well, the first step really is, I think, a lot of time is just exposing the irrationality.
Well, I mean, everyone who's elected to the House of Representatives or the Senate, president, they take an oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. So when you have like a representative Schiff, you know, putting pressure on Amazon to digitally burn books, and he should be called to account and be censored for that.
Yes,
he's violating his own oath of office, and it's, you know, things like that. Obviously, I don't presume good faith in it. Not like if I point this out, they're going to say, "Oh, you're right. I'm going to correct my ways. I'm not going to do this anymore." But just the public should be aware of this. Like, you know, or when they try to pass a law that a federal law that punishes those people who are supporting the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, you know, movement against Israel, that in the federal law denying, you know, federal contracts or allowing states to do this. You know, we've had this example where like Texas hurricane relief was apparently the condition of getting hurricane relief funds was you not supporting the boycotting of Israel. I don't see the connection there, but it just shows you, you know, really.
Well, I mean, yeah, but, you know, just think about how from the, you know, the Constitution's creation to the present time, how few people were aware of the project, the Masonic Genocide Project. Man, it was just a handful throughout history. Most of them were just wiped out immediately.
Well, but most people are fighting it on a case-by-case basis. They're not aware of a long-term plan.
Exactly. You know, but you see, that's something that we can actually get, I think, people to start being aware of. I mean, I know they're being mind controlled in universities, but man, the internet is really—it's just alive with these.
Well,
kinds
I mean, there was once an anti-Masonic party, right? In the 19th century, in the murder of Morgan, William Morgan.
Well, I think actually, I mean, I can't actually prove this, but I will give my conjecture. I think the Shea Rebellion was anti-Masonic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of like you know, speculation about this. And interestingly, this was where Prince Hall becomes basically the head of the Black Masonic Lodge systems. Prince Hall's a real guy and made his fame by saying, you know, we Black Lodge members will attack the Shays Rebellion. And that was, you know, kind of an interesting a fact in terms of, you know, was the Shays Rebellion, what kind of anti-Masonic, you know, plot was actually, you know, embedded inside that rebellion. The problem, of course, is that history, you know, is controlled, and so you don't really know what documents are actually going to, you know, make it to us. But I think it's possible, and in any case, it's nice to you know, have as a kind of a fantasy and an inspiration, and It's a way to, you know, let's just try to make the current rebellion a little more focused into exposing what is obviously, you know, a project by these tiny group, which leads to so much death and destruction. You know, we need to like just keep showing the history so that people can, you know, get it. And then hopefully, you know, once the information is widespread enough, we can actually start having some political, you know, changes.
Yeah, and if you doubt the role of Freemasonry in the formation of the United States and what that really means, what the United States is and represents in the world, just take a tour around the nation's capital. And...
Yeah, how about looking at the dollar bill? I mean, it's just preposterous, you know, like when you've got the all-seeing eye in a pyramid staring at you every time you try to, you know, cash a buck. Mm-hmm. You know, with the 13 arrows and all these Masonic, you know, imagery. I mean, for God's sakes, you don't see a crucifix on the dollar bill, you know. You know, George Washington wasn't wearing a rosary when he was inaugurated. I mean, it's clear who's in control. People just, you know, they just will not, you know, step out of their comfort zone to recognize both the history and the symbolism. You know, so they can recognize they're enslaved, you know, by this process, this system.
Yeah, but they're given the theatrics and the facade of a republic, of electoral process and of political parties, and sort of superficial participation, participatory democracy, as they say. And so that sort of ropes them in or makes them think that, you know, their opinion matters. And they're, you know, they're voting matters and these things, and you reaffirm the system when you do that. So, yeah, it's a realization that the fix is in, You know, I think there's one thing you can get if you look at history is that the fix is indeed in on these things. And it's the Constitution. I think it was Lysander Spooner who wrote the Constitution of No Authority. He said that the Constitution really is no good if it permits what has occurred. And this is the 19th century. Then it's no good. If it didn't prevent it, then it's still no good. So what do you have?
Touché.
You know, it's not gonna, it's a parchment buried to tyranny. And you know, that's about as good as, you know, strong as the paper that is written on. But you're right. Yeah. It's basically as, you know, as society has developed and it's developed along Masonic lines, they've just kind of twisted and contorted the law to fit their agenda. That they don't abide by it. That's the point. That's a, you know.
Yeah, well, there's nothing. You know, there's no law to abide by. The only law to that, that yeah. this nation abides by or ever has is power.
Yeah.
Murder. You know, and while all the time with the smiling face, you know, to the public. But frankly, I'm just sick of it. I don't even care, you know, who smiles at me from the TV set anymore. I know that these people are just lying their heads off. And we have to, like, you know, step forward as humans to protect ourselves. And that's the basic thing, is to not let the intimidation keep us from speaking out, you know. I mean, this is the problem. And part of it is also, is just, you know, I think is bad history. And that's why I know that, you know, the review we did about the Constitution's creation tonight wasn't exhaustive, but it's a really good place for people to start research.
Yeah, I mean, it was called a conspiracy in Philadelphia because really the convention, they were authorized to reform and amend the Articles of Confederation. They're not given any authority to you know, write a new document. So from the get-go,
where the federal power would be so concentrated. Yeah, that was, again, it was just, you could see it though, because it's easy to trace if you just remember that this wasn't Franklin's first constitution. You know, go back to the Lodge system constitution of 1734 that he printed, and you can see it's all there. I mean, basically, they're trying to create the Freemason system of control and present it to the public as a political system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really kind of what we have. It's the Lodge system with the Grand Lodge, and then underneath, you know, you have the oath taking, and that's what keeps the system intact, is that, you know, they have levels of, you know, where you have different kinds of information kind of access. But underneath, you have a whole system of oath taking so that no one will rebel. I mean, that's really what, you know, when we you know, do the Pledge of Allegiance or, you know, the oaths when you become a soldier, basically you're just part of the Masonic Lodge process. Now you're just taking a low level oath. And that's part of what keeps people, you know, in check, you know, from both seeing, you know, what's going on and also rebelling.
Yeah, I think it's been referred to as the cathedral, sort of this canon of acceptable thought, and it's imposed, and we can see the bodies that do this. You know, it's outfits like the Council of Foreign Relations. This coordinates governmental policy, media, even Hollywood and entertainment. That's why you have journalists, government officials, diplomats, writers, actors, you know, actresses, part of the, you know, the SCFR and these things. And that's an example. I think another example is just how the influence of various foundations in controlling education. Of course, we talked recently about the General Education Board of Rockefeller's thing, how he endowed it with, you know, with $130 million in 1902 to change, take over education, medical industry, these things. And so these are all very, you know, you could look at, you know, the outfits like the CFR as sort of Masonic operation, and how they control the media and these things. All these various entities seem to be independent, but they're not. They're all interlinked, and they're controlled from the center.
Yeah, and you can really, you know, there's a couple things, like I just call them the fingerprints, you know, like one of them, if you look at Rockefeller's, his seizure of the monopoly and how this was something that was set up by, you know, Harriman and the Rothschilds. I mean, it's just transparent, right? There's no way you can get around that. He got the cheap rates. He was able to, like, get the oil to the market, like, at half price. So all the other competitors disappeared. But see, now you look at Rockefeller's foundation's behavior, the stuff he was using the money for, and then when you see that, you know, nutritional medicine is destroyed, you know, and the whole system that the Rockefeller set in, a foundation control over like education, well, you can see it is, you know, like these foundations, you know, the Rockefeller, the Ford, Skull and Bones, you know, all they all have the same DNA. That's the thing. They have the same DNA. And that's why no matter what happened, no matter what they do, it always ends up with the same result for the population.
Yeah, it traces back to the Rockefellers, traced back to the Rothschilds. I think the National City Bank, they think they own that bank, which financed a lot of Rockefeller's early ventures. But of course, the Bank of England, which by the time of Rockefeller's ascendancy was controlled by the Rothschilds in England, where a lot of the, you know, the through intermarriage and these things, that crypto, I think a lot of cryptos have taken over that, and that so they spread their tentacles into the United States financial.
Like heroin. I mean, the thing is that, and then Skull and Bones. I mean, you've got just secret society stench everywhere, and then you have Jewish banking families funding things, and then somehow having amazing, they have this connection with the Rockefellers, who then incredibly have the same DNA in terms of behavior. Right. Wow. What a shock. And that's why it's like, I've mentioned this before. It's a criticism I have of E. Michael Jones, who is like my favorite scholar, except for Tim Keller. I mean, he's just terrific, you know, his research is so penetrating. He gets so many original ideas into the public that are valuable. I just hate to criticize him, but I will just point out that, you know, he sees this struggle where you have Catholicism, Judaism, and the Protestants, this triangle, this, you know, that's the major structure. When I look at our history from, you know, the constitution of the Freemasons that Benjamin Franklin started out with in 1735, all the way up to, you know, the decision to make pornography, you know, covered under freedom of speech, I just don't see anything that isn't really inside the Masonic world. See, I think that's a key thing that I would love to see, not just E. Michael Jones, but like all internet researchers, and a lot of them already do, of course, but it's really a useful thing. It's just to try to see, well, you know, when you look at like the Rockefellers or the Roosevelts, you know, what are you really looking at in terms of, you know, where is their power structure? Is it residing in Protestantism? You know, I don't think so. If it did, you'd have the McCarthy principle, which is what I'm calling that, you know, where if it wasn't a conspiracy, there'd be an occasional change or slip up. Well, the fact that it's 100% always going against our interests, I think you know that there's cooperation and coordination that isn't just, you know, like inside that the tri-religious structure. You know, there's something beyond that. And I think the Masons are really like have always been what, you know, basically branches that, and their relationship with Jewish finance.
Yeah.
You know, because those two forces.
Well, they successfully, the banking systems of the West were more or less became, you know, they're judicized, as they say, with usury, and once you get that, you get the concentration of wealth and control. And with the E. Michael Jones, it makes the case that a lot of this will stem back to the Protestant Reformation, and how the people rebelling against the church tended to be Judaizers, because they were appealed to the Old Testament. And then this was the Jews' inroads, and
the thing is,
intermarriage in these things, and yeah. So it's very, and of course the whole issue of, you know, of false conversions in the 15th century,
right? Until you have the conversos, and who's the conversos? Yeah. This is why I always say, look, to the extent we can get DNA testing, we should be getting it, because this would help us understand like who actually created the Constitution. And why there is this, why we never get a break. Why does the McCarthy principle never, ever, ever get violated, you know? And so, you know, it's these are, you know, these are the real questions going forward. But I think that, you know, we can now at least say to Goethe, you know, we may be hopelessly enslaved, but we don't falsely believe it. So we've made some progress, buddy.
Okay, I think we covered it then.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much, Tim.
Okay, Joe.
Next week. All right, bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.